And that brings me to Zeke's Last Supper, a parable for the 21st century by Ezekiel J. Krahlin, K-R-A-H-L-I-N. And I want to point you to his website, or one of them, actually. He has more than one. This is probably where this story came from, gay-bible.org. And you can find out all you want to know, and maybe even a little more, by looking up Ezekiel J. Krahlin, K-R-A-H-L-I-N. He's been writing to me for a few weeks, and he called on the show a few weeks ago when we talked for about half an hour, and it was fascinating. A remarkable individual. So that Ezekiel J. Krahlin, Zeke's Last Supper, a parallel for the parable, Jesus, for the 21st century, Ezekiel J. Krahlin writes. Part 1. A recent email from my gay activist counterpart from the East Coast, Carlisle Lamburn, now inspires me to put an end to, once and for all, the belief that Jesus Christ really existed. What irks me most about this sham deification is how even some hardcore atheists believe he existed, at least as a historical figure, in spite of all evidence to the contrary. So how can yours truly, a simple and humble person, never given to flights of fancy of any sort except dragons, put the ultimate kibosh on this Jeebus myth? Obviously the only answer, is to travel back in time myself, document all relevant material at hand in this living laboratory of this Middle Eastern tempest in a Roman teapot. Thus equipped with my iPad knockoff, a refurbished Android tablet look-alike, only $138 at eBay, and my trusty scaled-down version of the Illudium Q36 explosive space modulator, a solstice gift from my dear friend Marvin, I set off in my temporal transmogrifier to the year in which their Lord was supposedly crucified, 33 A.D. And that goes down with an asterisk to temporal transmogrifier, my own invention, with the assist of several hacker allies from the Berkeley Unix Users Group, which I founded in 2001, only remotely similar to H.G. Wells' time machine, seeing as this device is not a physical conveyance of any type, but a form of astral projection triggered by electrodes attached about the skull and an intravenous feed composed of aloe vera gel, witch hazel, THC compounds, and liquefied Futurama DVDs. You know, that might work. To continue. The most vivid interaction with a past event lasts approximately 40 minutes, after which the impressions rapidly fade back into the present. Whatever recording and other equipment you choose to bring must be light in weight and limited to no more than two items, else their parallel astral accompaniment will become sporadic and unreliable, thus any evidence preserved tenuous. I set the date on my transmogrifier's LED panel for mid-afternoon, April 1, 33 A.D., the day on which the Last Supper supposedly occurred. Right, April Fool's Day, go figure. Soon I am in deep trance, and my present reality becomes a thing of the future. I find myself standing in Old Jerusalem's historic marketplace amidst a teeming throng of bartering Jews, Romans, Greeks, Phoenicians, Egyptian slaves, Moabites, Canaanites, Edomites, Thracian mercenaries, Bedouin tribes with their camel caravans, and even a troglodyte or two. The sweet scent of dried figs, apricots, dates, and pomegranate seeds mingles with the tantalizing odors of crusty leavened bread, still oven-warm, juicy cucumber slices, lemons, pulses boiled with cardamom and sumac, and the smoky tang of fire-roasted goat meat and lamb. I drool for a shawarma, S-H-A-W-A-R, M.A. I don't know what that is. All social strati are represented, from the ragged beggars to the local upper classes that reside in the neighborhood just adjacent to and east of the marketplace. The flawless linen robes of the wealthy glimmer under the hot sun with fine gold thread woven into exquisite patterns, set off with sparkling faceted sapphires, rubies, emeralds, opal cabochons, and Persian beadwork. Even their slaves are outfitted in robes and capes far more resplendent than those of the merchants and visiting luminaries. Glimpses of Herod's palace flicker in the distant west between the passing shoppers like a 19th century zoetrope. And the walls of the great temple rise above the city's northeast horizon like a limestone and cedar palisade of giants trimmed in gold. The sere pale blue sky is kissed by puffs of white clouds scudding by in the desert wind. Dizzy from the sudden and brilliant onslaught of a new world, I have to catch my breath or faint dead onto the stone masonry. I feel like I'm in a Cecil B. DeMille extravaganza, only this marketplace is more real, more immediate than any Hollywood props and extras could ever accomplish. I sweat profusely in the solar-baked heat, yet paradoxically am cooled by my rough linen undergarments, scratchy though they be. I grab my iPad wannabe through this dusty shepherd's robe that clings loosely to my frame to be sure it is well hidden and secured in an oxblood sash flung tightly round my midriff. The space modulator rests alongside, a bit lumpy but not uncomfortable, like a gun holster. To my surprise, coins jingle in a pocket that hangs within the cloak's left side. Silver, gold, and bronze pieces clatter in a cacophony of mercantile glee. Some of these coins bear imprints of Herod and Caesar, while others depict grape clusters, crested helmets, eagles, and kings, queens, gods, goddesses, and mythical beasts of unknown origin, at least to my limited knowledge. Many are scribed in Greek characters, some Aramaic. There arises a reckless hollering in a small crowd several stalls up from where I stand. Some long-haired lunatic wielding a corded whip is knocking down merchant stands and screaming blasphemy. Glistening stacks of wet grape leaves, small urns flush with cracked olives and pepper pods swimming in sea brine, square wooden trays piled with reddish-brown lumps of drying seaweed, clay bowls wobbling with dense camel's milk curd that threatens to flow over, and smoked fish wrapped in clean papyri tumble to the ground as leprous orphans scramble to procure the precious windfall. My attention is then drawn back to this lunatic. Quite dashing in face, I observe, especially that trim jet mustache and beatnik hipster goatee. Outlines of buff muscle reveal themselves in thighs, biceps, and pecs beneath his double-robe ensemble, dyed in rich hues of cobalt and crimson. Definitely GQ material, in spite of this disturbing and unwarranted outbreak. He then spits repeatedly, and most menacingly, I couldn't help notice, upon a muster of caged baby peacocks pooping over a large wicker basket loaded with fragrant dew melons. He's quickly dragged away by Roman centurions, and the usual bartering babble resumes. Why are the hottest men always so unstable? I gripe to myself, speaking from experience of more than 30 years in the Castro. Judas, you shaved! A voice suddenly booms behind me, and I drop the coins back into my pocket with a flurry of clinks. I turn to see a tall, rather gaunt male rush up to me and embrace my shoulders with ferocious affection. Yes. Better think quickly. Yes, I did, just this morning. As startled as I am to find myself in the arms of a stranger who died almost 2,000 years ago, I am equally shocked to discover that I can speak in fluent Aramaic. Obviously, the adventure has begun. He presses against my space modulator and instantly steps back. Ouch! What in Yahweh's name is glued to your chest, a melted-down idol of Baal? I place my hand over the lump in order to prevent its discovery. Ha ha! Very funny, my friend. Once more I think with the speed of Mercury. I lean into my unknown friend's ear and boldly whisper, "Why, they're silver utensils embossed with obsidian flakes for tonight's feast, loaned to me by my mother's commode slave." "Ah, I see," he replies, with a finger of mutual secrecy pressed to his lips. "No wonder you hide them under a cloak. Thieves abound in the agora." This stranger yet friend then grasped both my shoulders to admire the barber's handiwork. "But say, you look good without that beard, Judas. 10 years younger, at the least." He confesses, "Just last night, Jesus spoke to me in confidence. John, you need to have a talk with your bosom buddy Judas about that haggard old hairy crumb catcher. It's bad for group morale, not to mention public relations. Now, here we are, problem solved, without a single feeling hurt or argument uttered." I am astonished. Is this John the Apostle, the very John who Jesus loves most? They might even be gay lovers. What a scoop for the National Enspirer. I could make millions off the book. Heck, forget the book. Let's do the movie. Then another thought crosses my delirious mind. Wait a minute. Do I really look so much like Judas Iscariot as to be mistaken for him? There is considerable potential in this surprise twist. I'm going to milk this for all it's worth. Of course, in the heat of excitement, I forget all about my mission that brought me here in the first place. Never mind, though. Let's see where this goes. So I respond. Yes, well, Jesus came to me at first cockscrow to settle the matter. Surprise, surprise. What? John seems astonished. He's supposed to be on his way from Capernaum and isn't due to arrive till Apollo's chariot descends into the dark west. You seem to have forgotten something, my dear John, I calmly reply, like an adult to a naive toddler. Jesus can work miracles, so isn't it plain as the scarab on your change purse that this most trivial of miracles is but donkey's play to our heavenly master's only son? John blushes in embarrassment and looks down at his open-toed sandals made of sacrificial goat leather. Of course, he admits, and whacks himself on the side of his head with an open palm. How stupid of me. Then he clasps my hand in the friendly intimacy of intertwined fingers, as is the tradition in the Middle East for grown men to act so fey. We leave the open-air mall to parts as yet unknown by yours truly, arms linked and a-swing, like two Catholic schoolgirls off to merrily confess their sins to a horny old priest behind a dark screen. But such a scenario now lies in the distant future. Ancient Rome has other, less subtle ways to corrupt little girls. Come, let us set the table and prepare fine victuals for Jesus' last supper, declares John with unabandoned glee. You do realize, of course, that he's due to be crucified by tomorrow's eve. At least, that's his claim. John grips my arm firmly with his free hand, then continues, Personally, I think Jesus is a bit of a drama queen, and I don't think anything bad's going to happen. John pauses to watch a flock of buzzards fly overhead, flapping their wings in concert as they settle on a withered, bare old olive tree. He looks to me with a sparkle in his eye and pats my arm. So why not just drink and be merry? After all, consider the artichokes of the field, how they flourish. They neither boil away nor singe, and yet I say to you that even Salome in all her glory was not as tasty with sheep schmear like one of these. John's chest is now puffed up in pride over this newfound wisdom. Jesus needs a new speechwriter, I think, desperately. Part 2. The scene of ancient Jerusalem then fades, along with bosom pal John, as my 40-minute allotment has run its course. All becomes shadowy for a while, then pitch dark. I cannot wait to return, so enjoy a quick meal of non-GMO soy milk and raspberry granola before my assistant plugs me back into the temporal transmogrifier. Our laboratory, by the way, is nothing more than a makeshift double-bed room at a Motel 6, and off I go, once more, to expose the Jesus myth in all its deceptive glory. We pass through the gates of an obviously upper-crust household, which John says is the House of Zion, for it stands topmost on that holy mountain of the same name. All of Jerusalem is spread out at the base of this sacred hill, blinding white and gold buildings as far as the eye can behold. The setting sun casts deep rubicund rays across the spectacular and most bewitching panorama. A chill, crisp breeze anoints the searing air like a gentle mist. David's tomb lies just beneath this structure, remarks John, as we climb the narrow stairway to the second floor where the Last Supper is in the final stages of preparation. Most of the 12 apostles are already present. Missing are Bartholomew, Matthew, Thaddeus, and of course Judas. The dinnerware is already laid out, including utensils. They all pause in their preparations to welcome me and compliment how good I look clean-shaven. Each apostle exchanges a fond embrace before resuming his supper-time chores. Judas, says John, why don't you just exchange the silverware already laid out with your own thoughtful gifts? I'm sure Martha won't mind. I desperately grasp for an excuse. Oh, no, no, I don't think so. Now that I think of it, I'm certain my own tableware is overly elegant for such a humble and holy affair. I'll just hold on to them until I can return them in a day or two. As you wish, complies John, who then leaves me for the kitchen to prepare the finger bowls and spit cups. Spit cups? I then realize this is the opportune moment to descend the stairs and wait outside in hopes of intercepting Judas and convince him to go elsewhere. Only several minutes pass before I see him coming up the cobblestone walkway. Hey! You look like me, he remarks in curious surprise. Who are you, one of the servants? Never mind that, I think fast. Will this inspire you to stay away for the night? I quickly deposit 30 shekels of tire into Judas's open hand to get him to shut up and leave. His eyes open wide with delight, and he quickly scoots off to the marketplace to suck on honey locust snow cones, his favorite way to beat the desert heat. Three more dinner guests jovially walk hand in hand up the steep walkway in my direction. I quickly learn they are the three missing apostles, Bart, Matt, and Thaddee. I return with them to the upper chambers of the House of Zion, where the holy feast will soon commence. Ruddy brown saltwater dishes cast a warm glow on the linen tablecloth, and deep blue ceramic glazed wine vessels sparkle and reflect from the flames of flickery oil lamps. A kiddush cup rests at one end, where I presume Jesus will sit. A large white platter is placed in the center, generously burdened with two large shanks of juicy roast lamb, smothered in a fairy jungle of bitter herbs. Several young maidens, dressed in silken robes of white and silver, their lustrous brown or black flowing hair plaited with blue ribbon, wash the apostles' feet and invite me to sit by a basin of chilled water. I gratefully slip off my sandals to enjoy a cool, gentle foot massage scented with sage. Through an open archway, I watch the large blob of orange sun slowly dip below the desert dunes. I must have dozed off for some minutes, for I was suddenly awakened by a servant's announcement. Jesus number 2 and 6 have just passed through Martha's gate. 2 and 6? What's up with that, I think, and arise, cross over to the balcony. It's nightfall. Below, I see two tall and white-robed, clean-shaven young men speak jovially with arms linked, walk up the stone path, and disappear beneath my feet. The four maidens quickly remove their water basins and stand at the stair's top to greet their saviors. The apostles stand nearby in eager suspense. When in Jerusalem, do as the Jerusalemites do. I defer to the situation and rise to stand among my worshipful compatriots. The two Jesuses turn a corner up the stairway and are quickly relieved of their top robes by these entranced maidens, then escorted to a row of chairs against one wall, with fresh basins of scented water to cleanse their dusty feet. Each disciple hugs and kisses Jesus number 2 and Jesus 6 smack dab on the lips. Taken aback by this weird turn of events, two Jesuses, I step back into a corner shadow, hoping to not be noticed. Jesus number 6 speaks up. Come, Judas, don't be shy. Not on this most momentous of nights, and he waves me over. I approach. He grabs my hand to pull me onto his lap. I yield to find myself in the strong, hairy arms of Jesus. He has liquid hazel eyes. Honey-brown hair clipped neatly on the sides and top, but falls in luxurious streaked curls down the nape of his neck. That's a mullet, I observe. They didn't even have mullets till the 1960s. Then I also notice a tattoo of an anchor on his thick, smooth neck as he presses those pouty lips onto mine. His slick tongue slides against my own and lingers a while. This is hot, I think, and lose myself in the moment with firm embrace and tongue action that would make the whore of Babylon blush. An obviously thick and more than ample boner boldly pushes up against my arse crack. The other Jesus, sporting buzz-cut black hair and a single pierced earring of sterling silver that seems to depict a Viking rune, already has a hand discreetly slipped under my robe. He grasps my tumescent rod of Aaron with delicious intent, which quickly grows hard in a secret place near the iPad knockoff. You look simply bodacious with that beard shaved away, Judas, whispers Jesus number 2 into my ear like a cool winter breeze off Mount Gilboa. No, it's spearmint. He's chewing a wad of gum, for Christ's sake. Just how anachronistically warped are things going to get before I have to shut down the experiment or deem it useless? I notice underneath his robe some sort of plaid skivvies. Curious, plaid wasn't invented until the 5th century in Ireland. He squeezes my Johnson with the passion of a rabbi's prayer on Shabbat. You will belay me before the night has passed, he puns. I raise my head to kiss those spirit-sweet lips. Lightning suddenly streaks the starlit sky, and a cock crows. "Stupid rooster!" screams James, son of Alphaeus, and kicks the hapless fowl off the balcony and onto the bed of rose-mallow and barley grass below. His wine jar is already emptied, I observe. A servant courteously refills his jar to the brim. It is then I notice all the apostles, plus the two Jesuses, are already drunk in various shades. Yet the feast has not begun. What are we waiting for, the other Jesuses? I grow a bit plucky and address the Jesus whose hand is up my thighs. Just how many Jesuses are there? I demand of Savior 2, who removes his hand from my privates and drunkenly stands up to press the wrinkles out of his now cum-stained robe. I rise from the other Jesus's lap to stand beside him, insistent for an answer. The faux Savior drapes an arm around my shoulder, spilling what drops remain in his carafe. Well, my good friend, he confides to my left ear, at last count it was 11. He almost slips to the floor with a second hiccup, but I pull him up and brace him against a beam. 11, huh? I echo. Jesus number 2 now leans hard against me, one hand on my buttocks, and confides, yesh, 11. But you can never be sure. These are fast-paced days, what with the newer transmogrifers coming out of the integral hic arctic patent offices hic these days. Transmogrifiers, eh? Intergalactic patent offices. My invention has sure come a long way. At this point in our talk, Jesus, too, slicks up his hand with some olive oil from a small serving bowl and places it once more under my robe. Slippery, rough fingers grasp the base of my shaft and begin gliding up and down. Like a slow piston, I grow feverishly turgid, so decide to take this to the next level. Is there a room somewhere? I whisper. Yesh. Yesh, lots and lots of rooms. He moves through a draped archway, tugging clumsily at my sleeve, leads me to a cool dim room with a breathtaking view of the great temple lit up by nighttime sconces. There's a latch on the door, which I deftly lower into place. Messiah, too, drops his robe and undergarments to the polished cedar floor to reveal a vision of Adonai with a rump so tight and bouncy I quickly find myself humping my way through St. Peter's pearly gates. Screw the foreplay. I'm on the department's time clock. It's 2 o'clock. You're tuned to KNYOLP in Fort Bragg or KMECLP Ukiah. And I'm reading you a story titled Zeke's Last Supper, a parable for the 21st century by Ezekiel J. Crollin. And I'm going to play a little music and then I'll read you part 3. Well,